This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Tomczyk, and for Mike Collins. When landlords summarily refuse to rent to anyone who has an arrest record, they may effectively and disproportionately bar the door to millions of folks of color for no good reason at all. Those are the words of the country's top housing official, Julian Castro, as he announced new guidance this month on what constitutes housing discrimination. We're going to explore that guidance over the next hour. We'll get perspective from landlords as well as those who help ex-offenders re-enter their communities. First, we're joined over the phone by Brian Green from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. A former fair housing investigator in Boston, Green now oversees the policy and management of HUD's Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity Office. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Why did the federal government decide this new guidance is necessary?
Well, it's important because we have received requests to help housing providers understand their obligations under the Fair Housing Act, as certain policies can have a disparate impact on certain populations. So I think, first of all, it's important to understand that the federal government does not create landlord policies. Private landlords are free to establish their own policies, but private landlords cannot discriminate against different groups. The Federal Fair Housing Act, 48-year-old law, has long established that you can't discriminate on the basis of race, color, national origin, and several other bases. And so that law is not new. And under the law and under the case law, if there are certain practices that have a disparate impact on certain populations, say based on race or national origin, those laws can also violate the fair. Those practices can also violate the Fair Housing Act. And so, a question we've often received is: okay, if someone has a criminal history for any range of offenses, and a housing provider excludes someone based on that criminal history, are there situations where such denial can constitute discrimination on the basis of race or national origin or some other basis? And so we found it important, even though the Fair Housing Act's been out for 48 years, and disparate impact doctrine is a longstanding doctrine for proving discrimination, we thought it was important to spell out those circumstances where such screening practices could violate the Fair Housing Act.
How common is it for landlords to deny applicants based on criminal record?
You know, you see a range of practices. I would say that there are a good number of housing providers who don't have such a practice because in this country today, we have 100 million persons with some form of criminal record. And, you know, many of those people are in housing and have been housing for many years. So certainly not every landlord has such a practice. But there are a good number who do, a good number such that this policy statement, or this guidance rather, was important for us to put out so that they could understand their obligations of the Fair Housing Act and not get into trouble.
And how much does technology contribute to this? I mean, I've read that it is just so much easier and cheaper now to check someone's criminal record than it was, you know, years ago.
Well, yes. I mean, that's true. You can gather that information very quickly. You know, there's always some question, though, with technology, you know, whether the information you're gathering is up to date and accurate. And so I think it's important, even though it may be easier to do that, that landlords actually have policies that are clearly tailored to the to their business necessity, like what they're trying to ensure in their properties, and so that regardless of what information they're getting out of the system, they know what really is going to matter in making a successful tenant, and that they evaluate that information to determine whether it actually has any bearing on that person's ability to be a good tenant.
So let's get into the new guidelines. In simple terms, what are y'all laying out?
So again, the federal government does not establish landlord policies. So landlords are free to have whatever practices they choose, provided they not discriminate against people. And so our guidance points out that, when someone challenges a practice under the Fair Housing Act, a landlord's got to be able to defend that practice serves a substantial and legitimate purpose that's necessary for living in housing. So, as I mentioned, there are certain practices that may be neutral on their face, but could have a discriminatory effect. Just as an example, suppose you are a housing provider, and one of your requirements was you've got to be a member of the university club, or you've got to be a Freemason. Someone might say, well, this is discriminatory based on race or on gender, and challenge that policy. And a landlord may say, oh, well, I just, think this speaks to someone's character. That landlord would actually have to demonstrate that it's necessary for someone to have that qualification in order to pay the rent, in order to be a good neighbor, in order to ensure the health and safety of the other residents. So you can't just have arbitrary policies, or if you do have arbitrary policies, there's always a great chance you could be challenged on them. And if those arbitrary policies, have a statistical impact on certain groups, you've got to be able to articulate that it's of business necessity that you have that policy.
And the argument here is that arbitrary bans on folks with criminal records, because of the disproportionate likelihood of African Americans and Latinos to have an arrest record, would likely constitute discrimination in housing policy?
So certainly there are certain crimes that have a statistic where there's statistical evidence that shows that African Americans, Latinos have been disproportionately arrested and convicted of such crimes. And so the question is, if a housing provider is saying that they would exclude all applicants who have that particular criminal record, they would have to show, in light of those statistics, that what they're requiring in housing is essential and necessary for a good tenant. So you may have people who, were picked up at 18 in their neighborhood for possessing a joint, and now they're 40, good job, solid credit, been living in housing for some time, and a landlord in their criminal screening picks this up and says, no, I can't rent to you. And if it's a particular crime like drug possession, which in many communities that police patrol have disproportionately affected certain populations, that landlord may be excluding a perfectly good tenant and would have to explain why that particular policy is necessary in light of the impact it would have on certain populations.
With that example where it's, a minor offense from decades ago, even with that being the case, let's say that landlord says, okay, we're not going to rent to anyone who has even an arrest record, no matter how long ago it is. Would you guys say that would violate the policy?
So, yeah, we've stated pretty clearly that a policy that would exclude someone for just an arrest record that didn't lead to a conviction is illegitimate, because an arrest record just means that you were suspected of something, and a landlord would have a difficult time saying that such an arrest that did not ultimately lead to a conviction in and of itself is a necessary requirement to live in an apartment.
Well, let's say I'm a landlord and I have a blanket policy about convictions. I'm not going to rent to someone who has been convicted of a crime. What about that?
Well, again, as I said with the drug possession example, depending on the particular crime, I mean, you really have to, what we stress is you need to look at the nature and severity and recency of the conviction. And so if you say every single conviction bars you from housing, you may be excluding people who can be good tenants, and the point again is if it has a disproportionate effect on a particular population, that could violate the law. And so, with the drug example I gave, you would have to explain, you know, why, you know, minor drug possession or conviction for some other offense would affect either the other tenants. You know, if you know, one of your objectives is to ensure the health and safety of the other residents, or, you know, that somehow this is going to prevent them from paying the rent, you've got to be able to show that there's going to be an impact on your vital business objectives. And, you know, that may be different for different crimes. And so it's very important that you actually tailor your policies towards the specific objective you have as a landlord.
And when you say you have to be able to show, that is to the federal government, that is to a judge if a lawsuit is brought? Like, at what point does that check come into play?
Right. Well, that's a very good point. So the whole point here is, if you've got a policy as a private landlord, it could be challenged if someone's denied because of such screening practices, either in a court or in an administrative forum like at HUD, if someone files a housing discrimination complaint with HUD. So landlords are free to establish whatever policies and practices they choose, but if someone alleges discrimination in that situation, they've got to be able to defend that policy that it achieves a valid business objective.
I'd like to go through a couple more examples just to try to really iron this out. So let's say you're convicted of a felony. If you have a policy of not renting to convicted felons, would that violate it?
Well, again, there's a whole range of felonies.
Let's say it's a violent one.
Right. And so, again, we've said that you need to look at the nature, severity, and the recency of it. So if someone is now 70 and is seeking to rent, and they at 18 were charged with a violent felony, you need to look at the total circumstances. And, you know, you probably have, in some situations like that, people who have rented for decades, people who have landlord references, and that might be part of your screening practice to go to landlord references. And, you know, people have said, no, you know, these folks have been good tenants for decades. So you it's up to the landlord to determine what matters for them in housing and to, of course, treat everyone the same. But in the case of something like a felony conviction, to evaluate that felony conviction in light of what they're seeking to achieve in housing, and to consider the nature, severity, and the recency of it.
So it sounds like even in the example of felony convictions, potentially you still could be sued if you have a blanket ban. You need to be considering even the severity and time of felony convictions.
Right. So you may have a legitimate reason for certain felony convictions to exclude people, but in a situation where such an exclusion could constitute discrimination on the basis of race or gender, national origin, you should be able to explain, should someone file a complaint, so should someone sue you, why you must exclude that person for that particular crime at that time.
We need to take a short break. We'll be joined by folks representing landlords and ex-offenders in a few minutes. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE. More from Brian Green as well, just after a break.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, local nonprofit blood center serving 27 local hospitals. Donors can give the gift of life by donating blood or platelets. Appointments at cbcc.us. And the 2016 Wells Fargo Championship, held May 2nd through the 8th at Charlotte's Quail Hollow Club. Tickets available at wellsfargochampionship.com. The United States has had a contentious relationship with immigration almost from the beginning, despite our being a nation of immigrants. And immigration is a theme in this year's election. Polls tell us it's one of the most important issues to voters. As the face of America changes, we look at immigration politics and what could change or not after November. That's when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, In 1838, Jesuit priests at Georgetown University sold 272 slaves to keep the school afloat. Now the search is on to find the descendants, how Georgetown once relied on the slave trade, and efforts to reconcile with its past.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Tomczyk in for Mike Collins. We're talking to Brian Green of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. He's explaining the department's new guidance on how it's likely discriminatory if landlords refuse to rent to anyone with a criminal record. We're joined now in studio by Myra Clark, Executive Director of the Center for Community Transitions. It's a Charlotte organization that helps ex-offenders find housing, among other things. Myra, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Ken Zemanski is Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association, which represents landlords. Welcome to you, too.
Good morning, Mike.
Brian, I want to start back up with you. So from what we were just discussing, it sounds like in all cases, in most cases, these blanket bans where you would just flat out refuse to rent to anyone with a criminal record could result in a lawsuit, could violate the act. I'm wondering, so a step beneath having a blanket ban then, what is the right way to carry out this policy as a landlord? Does it require a conversation about the offense? Does it require more research on what the offense was?
Right. So just to clarify a couple of things, I would not say that because someone has such a practice that it would result in a lawsuit. I mean, very few people have filed complaints or lawsuits over this issue, but there's a chance that someone, if someone had a blanket ban, might file a lawsuit. And as I was saying, that you would have to be able to defend the practice. So what's good for every housing provider to do when they establish their policies is to be sure that their policies are actually tailored to the specific business necessity that they have as a housing provider. And so if a situation arises and if as one of your policies you do a criminal background check, if a situation arises where it shows a past arrest or past conviction, you should engage in a process with that person to determine whether or not the conviction actually involves something that would violate your needs as a housing provider. Would the nature, the severity, and the time that this occurred prevent you from renting to that person because they might be a risk to other people?
And is there a rule of thumb or more particular guidance the department is giving to landlords for, somewhere within this gray area, so to speak, of where you would be crossing the line? Because to give you an example, just to see if this would be helpful, a nonviolent felony that occurred 10 years ago and there's been no issues since. What would be the right thing to do under this policy as a landlord?
Well, again, we've issued 10 pages of guidance on it, right? So that is HUD's effort to provide this kind of guidance to folks. There is some case law, but I would say, again, that the housing provider would have to decide why they would deny that person. Like, why would they?
What would be an acceptable answer?
Well, if the purpose of the landlord screening is to make sure they can pay the rent and that they will be good neighbors and good tenants, and not pose any health or safety risk to others, it's very possible that a nonviolent past offense would not affect the other residents. So, you think of the rock stars, the celebrities who've been busted for marijuana. Would you say that because of that past offense, despite the fact that they could afford to live in a luxury development near you, that they pose a health and safety risk to others? I think you really have to look at the particular person and their circumstances and the ability to be good tenants. And for many past offenses, especially nonviolent offenses, it would be hard for a landlord to say that this is actually affecting the health and safety of the other residents.
I'd like to bring Ken Zemanski from the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association into this conversation here. Ken, how standard is it for when looking at an application for a criminal history, for that to be part of the process, for you to see whether someone in fact had an arrest record, has a criminal record?
It's become the industry norm for a number of years, and particularly with respect to felonies and further with respect to violent felonies, it's often the basis for exclusion. Misdemeanors oftentimes are not the basis for exclusion, and nonviolent felonies typically will be viewed as the recency factor in terms of when it took place, when the conviction took place, and how long the applicant has had a clean record.
So if felonies are typically used for exclusion under this, does that mean that you will need to change that policy?
Well, I think arguably. I mean, we respect and take seriously the new HUD guidelines that came out earlier this month. We have a few questions about it as an industry. In general, the guidelines are calling for an individualized approach, but that seems like it might make the housing provider and the screening entity take different approaches to different individuals. And it may be that you say, well, this individual, maybe they have to be clean for 5 years and someone else might have to be clean for 8 years based on some mitigating factor or going through rehab. But then that might raise the question about whether you are consistent with those respective applicants. And, you know, it's a difficult area to assess. And we think case law will probably be stemming from the guidelines and from field conditions going forward.
Brian, do you have any guidance there?
Well, you know, I think Ken's right. You can't treat different people differently based on race. But again, if there is a particular practice or, you know, particular crime that a landlord is saying you can't live there for, the landlord really does have to be sure that they're tailoring that approach so that they're not applying a standard that would be unfair in all circumstances.
So, Ken, walk me through, how would you tailor that approach?
Well, you'd look at the totality of an individual and maybe have written guidelines with your company and look at the nature, the severity, recency, other factors in terms of behavior, rehabilitation steps they've gone through. You're trying to assess the risk, and it's hard to do that. It's hard to determine and forecast how foreseeable a subsequent bad act might be. And that's one of the concerns that housing providers have is that, okay, you should have known potentially that that second bad act might take place in the future. You might get sued because one of your other residents gets injured. And their lawyer might say, well, that was a foreseeable event. You shouldn't have leased to them. It's your fault that they got injured. So the extent to which we can discern the quote-unquote direct threat is going to be a muddy area.
And especially with the liability piece, how does this, I guess, change your equation for is there potential for this to make you more liable?
Well, there is. And, you know, one example, it's kind of an extreme example, is the sex offender registry, which is a red flag, a white flag to most individuals in society. And that registry is as a result of government actions and inclusion. And most of the general public know about that and the geographic locations of those individuals where they reside either in or near a given community. And, you know, we don't have anything to do with that determination of the registry, who's on it, how long they're on it, the severity of the misconduct that they may have performed. You know, and we think that's kind of a government action about whether an individual should be on that registry or not. It's not a housing provider's decision to make because we're not in the criminal justice world.
And
if
I could
say something on that, I mean, and that may be a certainly a valid reason to exclude people because you've got this government direction, and you know, if based on your own assessment, those people are risks, you can exclude them.
Oh, Myra, go ahead.
Well, I would say that that might be a valid reason to exclude them, but not all sex offenses are the same. And so I think that would also warrant some inquiry by an apartment rental situation. I think, I mean, really what we're talking about is what we've talked about in terms of employment, that you look at the person and what they have to offer to the job. And the same is true with apartment rental. You look at the individual situation and you determine really what the risk is going to be for your community. But I think from what I hear from our clients, it's that this policy is being considered as a blanket policy rather than they're being looked at as individuals.
And Myra, you work with folks who have records all of the time and help them to reenter society. How common is it for, because of that, housing to be very difficult for them to find?
Well, it's extremely difficult for folks with criminal records to find housing, especially in apartment complexes. Where we find the best opportunity for folks to find housing is with individual landlords who own property throughout Charlotte, that you can meet with that person and really explain what your situation has been, where you are now, that you're, you know, in many situations that you're working, that you can afford the rent, you can prove that. And individual landlords are more likely to do that. But I don't know of hardly anyone who has gone to live in an apartment complex and who had a criminal record.
Really, anyone?
I don't know very, very few.
Wow.
If there are any that I can recall.
And Brian, if I'm understanding the new guidance correctly, I mean, if you have a flat-out ban, that would violate the policy.
Certainly, if you had a flat-out ban on people who've been arrested without any other conviction, and then, yeah, I would say for convictions as well, you should do analysis. But I do think it's important to point out that right now, you know, whatever practices the industry follows, we don't see many people filing complaints alleging discrimination, and we don't see many lawsuits around this. Our guidance is pointing out that should we see those, should individuals exercise those rights, here are the circumstances where it could violate the law. So this would have been true. This would have been, you know, how we would have looked at the cases before now as well. It just so happens that, you know, Supreme Court has affirmed disparate impact as a way of proving housing discrimination, and many people are now getting alert to the fact that certain practices could violate the law, and they've asked us for guidance on this. And so I think it's very important for housing providers to take a second look to be sure that that their particular policies are tailored and addressing the issues that what they're seeking in housing from a resident, and you want a policy that finds you good tenants, but that doesn't exclude people who could also be good tenants by painting people with too broad a brush.
Ken, how clear is the guidance to you and to landlords as they're looking at this?
I think it's clear that a different approach is warranted and will be needed going forward. You know, there are some questions about the Supreme Court decision on the disparate impact, which they cited the robust causality, a cause and effect between your policy and a discriminatory impact or effect, and citing statistical figures. There was no mention of the causality in the HUD guidance, and I'd ask Brian about maybe why that was excluded, if that was intentional or unintentional.
It's there. Maybe, Ken, I'll send you where it's stated, but we've always said there needs to be causality.
You know, the other thing I'd mention, you know, Brian mentioned the recent rental history of that ex-offender. In many cases, they haven't had the rental history because they've been excluded, you know, for a long time. That's been, you know, no felony renting has been the policy of the industry for a long, long time. So you've had a whole kind of an underclass of individuals that haven't been lessees. They've been living sometimes in apartments as unauthorized resident.
Yeah, and while that may be true, I think you have a wide range of landlords, right? You have your mom-and-pop landlords, and then you also have big apartment complexes. So I think there are situations where people have established that rental history. I mean, as we say in our guidance, Today, a third of the adult population has some form of criminal record. So, you know, you've got a good number of people who are in some form of housing. And then I would say, you know, in the situation where perhaps they're going to rent from a big landlord that has a criminal screening policy, you know, when there is that interactive process, there's an opportunity for that person to show that they've been a responsible citizen and that they you know, have not committed any further crimes and that they've actually been supporting themselves and showing that they can be good neighbors.
And Brian, you've mentioned a couple times that, that as of now there aren't necessarily a lot of lawsuits about this. Is that going to change? I mean, how is the federal government going to enforce this?
Well, it's certainly hard to predict, but the whole purpose of the guidance is to inform the public how we're going to evaluate these issues should someone allege that a particular policy violates the Fair Housing Act. And I think it's important to bring it back to that, that again, in all of these issues, the landlord is liable if the particular exclusion would constitute discrimination on the basis of race or national origin or sex, you know, one of the prohibited bases of the Fair Housing Act.
And how will you know if this this guidance is successful, if it is having the desired effect that, that you want it to have?
Well, I think already it's leading to a very robust conversation with people in the housing industry. And, you know, I've already spoken to some groups about it, and it also sounds like from, you know, what Ken's speaking to, this is something that, you know, professional industry takes seriously. And, you know, I think they have their own interests to make sure that, you know, they're finding the right tenants and not excluding people unfairly. So already, I believe, housing providers are taking notice. And like I said, many housing providers asked for this guidance because they were concerned how disparate impact might intersect with this issue.
Well, and I will say that we're very interested in this guidance also to open doors for people who really you haven't seen lawsuits because a lot of people just have accepted the fact that they're just not going to get housing there. And they didn't think that there was any backing for them to pursue anything further. And they've just accepted that as another condition of collateral punishment that they've had. And I think that this guidance is very helpful, just as there was guidance provided to employers about how to consider hiring someone who has a criminal record. And we, as an agency here in Charlotte, we've provided some risk assessments, we've provided some guidance, we've provided some educational opportunities for employers or for landlords to really make better choices about that.
I know that's Myra, and I know that this is all the time that Brian Green has. He's the federal government's General Deputy Assistant Secretary for Fair Housing. Brian, thank you so much for being part of this show.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
We'll keep this conversation going with Ken and Myra and get to some of your comments after a short break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Piedmont Plastic Surgery and Dermatology, serving Charlotte and the surrounding region with physicians specializing in plastic surgery, dermatology, facial rejuvenation, and Mohs surgery since 1994. More info at ppsd.com. And Bojangles, featuring two bacon, egg, and cheese biscuits on made-from-scratch buttermilk biscuits, served all day, every day. Available at area Bojangles. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, in 1838, Jesuit priests at Georgetown University sold 272 slaves to keep the school afloat. Now the search is on to find the descendants, how Georgetown once relied on the slave trade and efforts to reconcile with its past. That's The Diane Rehm Show at 10, this morning in about 20 minutes, here on 90.7 WFAE.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
The thing which would affect us most directly is any possibility of the frontier closing.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Roberts told those in attendance to encourage businesses and visitors to keep supporting Charlotte.
It is important to reinforce a message that Charlotte did the right thing.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Michael Tomczyk. We're discussing new federal guidance on what role a person's criminal record should play in a landlord's decision to rent or not rent to that person. Ken Zemanski is executive director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association, and Myra Clark is executive director of the Center for Community Transitions. If you'd like to join the conversation as well, you can look for WFAE on Facebook. Send us a tweet at Charlotte Talks. You can also email charlottetalks at wfae.org. Myra, I'd like to start with you. We've been talking a lot about the theory of this, essentially. You can put a face to this. You work with folks who are ex-offenders. How critical is this housing piece to all of the other aspects of reentering a community?
Well, I think it's very critical. I mean, two really important things that someone needs to successfully reenter the community is employment and housing. It's hard to manage employment if you don't have adequate housing, even though I know some people who do that regularly. But I think housing is extremely important, as the Homeless Service Network and other organizations have alluded to. But this is particularly for people with a criminal record. This is an extremely difficult thing to find is adequate housing.
And could you give some examples of folks that you've worked with who've encountered these challenges?
Well, we've had a one example would be a young woman who had a very good job, who had a criminal record, and she had applied to some apartment complexes. She was quite capable of affording really rent in an apartment complex, but because of her criminal record, she was not permitted to get an apartment there. And I think one of the difficulties is every time you apply to be in a place, you have a rental fee or you have an application fee you pay. So that becomes a little prohibitive in being able to go to multiple places. So but she did rent from an individual landlord, and she's quite satisfied where she is. But I think it's unfortunate that it's been looked at as a blanket policy.
How often has it been the answer for some of these folks is trying to find a mom and pop, trying to find an individual landlord?
That's been the answer for a lot of them. And it's hard to – there's no place to look up in the phone book, mom and pop rental, you know, organization here. So you really have to network to find places that you can rent.
And how does this fit into the problem of homelessness?
I think it fits into that in that a way that people find housing is to double up with someone else. And so they have to live with friends who are on the lease. And as Ken said, it may not be okay for them to be living in that house. But so there's a lot of things like that that happen, and they move around a lot because they can't find adequate housing.
And Ken, as far as I want to walk a little bit through what the normal process is. So in most cases, it sounds like a criminal record is or considering that is at least a part of the application. Is that accurate?
Very commonly.
And then so what happens next? Let's say as of now, someone is flagged for, you know, how detailed is the result that you see? Does it show exactly what the crime was? What happens next?
There are third-party companies that specialize in this, and there's many of them that are local, regional, and national. And they examine all the facts that they can gather about the individual's behavior, their rental history, their credit history, their criminal history. And those things, for many companies, are kind of a blended approach now in terms of whether they qualify or don't qualify. So, you know, one of the points I'd like to make, though, is the resident reaction to the new guidelines and the prospect's reactions to the new guidelines. In the context of the world we're in today with social media and everything being instantaneously available and that the word gets out and that may be difficult in terms of that current resident population or the prospective resident population of a given community in terms of what they think of it. People are all over the map, and consumers are in terms of what they think. Some are fine with it. Some are indifferent. Some would be, taken aback by that. And the other point I'd make about Myra's comment about the data, there's a great search here locally called North Carolina Housing Search that's got tens of thousands of rental units on it. And I bet we could talk to them about the nature of the provider and whether they're small, local, national, regional companies and the nature of the way they do their business.
You said some folks have been taken aback by it. Is that because of safety concerns?
Yeah. I mean, the word gets out. I heard this individual is moving in our community, and X number of years ago, they did this offense. And boy, that doesn't sound safe to me or to my kids. And I think we'll think twice about continuing to live here.
And have you heard of cases where, that maybe the better way to put it, based on what Brian said earlier, would be, would those examples be enough for you to tailor an argument that I'm not going to rent to someone who potentially could lead to other people moving out of my complex or my house?
We're not sure. We think that's going to be an evolving, part of the law and the implementation and the guidance. But that's very central to our concerns, is operating that business and what it means to our customers and our would-be customers.
Well, and Myra, on the safety point, I'm wondering there has to be a line somewhere, right, between, liability for what you do as a business on one end and an outright ban on renting to anyone who's had any kind of a record on the other. How do you help folks find that line?
Well, we look at the individual crime, the conviction, what circumstances were, who the person is today, what they've done to change or deal with their conviction. I'll even go to the violent crime. There are some people who've committed a violent crime that I would consider a good risk. What we see are people, women particularly, who've been in domestic violence situations. And they may have committed a violent crime, but it is highly unlikely that they would ever do that again. So that would be one of those circumstances where it would be based on what the situation was at the time that the crime was committed, how long ago that occurred, those kinds of things.
Yes, Ken?
So, Myra, are there good techniques of rehabilitation that society can point to as being, they worked well and that offender is going to have a limited likelihood of doing it again?
I think there are some. One of the most used ways now that has given us the best results is a cognitive behavioral approach to helping people learn how to think differently and look at more options than what they may have felt like they had at the time they may have committed the original crime. One other thing that has happened in North Carolina is something called a certificate of relief, which provides someone who's been incarcerated an opportunity to go before a judge and to receive a certificate of relief based on their actions and things that they have done since their incarceration to really help them return back to the community as a law-abiding, upholding citizen. And so that's something that that's available to many people.
And I think we would welcome that in terms of something that we could point to as something we could reliably hang the hat on.
Well, in getting to that, I mean, I guess what this policy to some degree is trying to accomplish is to create, case-by-case considerations. Do landlords even have the structure to do that right now? I mean, how often does some kind of flag related to a criminal offense result in an actual conversation about the severity of it, the time of it?
You mean during the tenancy or prior to the tenancy during the application process?
Prior to, during the application process.
Well, the third-party companies, have all the data at hand in terms of the history and the nature and the severity and when and all that. So oftentimes landlords will rely on that third-party entity in order to be viewed as being objective and not tailoring and not picking and choosing. They'll have a series of criteria that go into the computer, and those computer results will kick out who might make the grade and who might not quite make the grade.
I'd be curious, though, if it really looks at the circumstances of the crime, if that did evaluate that, because a lot of times it just pops out data that this has happened and da-da-da-da-da without there being a conversation or
– about the context.
About the context, yeah. Exactly.
Myra, are there some situations where your group will get involved in trying to talk to landlords about, look, this person, we've been working with them for X number of years. They've got this good job. You know, here's this we can somewhat explain what happened in the past. I mean, is that a conversation that you guys can be engaged in?
I think that is something that we can be engaged in. We are engaged with that in that with employers also. So we can be engaged in that conversation and would be more than happy to provide some training or guidance or, you know, answer questions for folks who are running apartment complexes to help them even parse out ways to look at this in the future to be sure that they're meeting the guidelines.
And I do think that with the new HUD guidance that there's going to be an open approach of housing providers to do what Myra suggests.
And while that makes sense, if essentially you're getting your recommendation from data that is spit out from a third party, how do you create room for that conversation?
I think that model will be modified some of the pure statistical approach and making it more subjective, more context-based.
And I'll just add that we also want to see people succeed. You know, we don't want someone to go into an apartment complex and then have that be a failure on the part of a person with a criminal record or on the part of the apartment complex who's trying to meet their business need. And I mean, it's the same method that we use with employers.
Yeah, and case management is really big with the homeless individuals and others that have special needs in terms of doing the best you can as a community to guarantee success.
Yeah, and we've had folks that we've gone in and helped. If there was an issue with an employee, we have met with the employee and the employer, and I think that we would be willing to do that with landlords also if there was an issue.
We have an email from Chris. He says, the great thing about fair housing laws was that it forced landlords to evaluate prospective residents in a consistent way. He says, now landlords can choose to apply rules to one person and not another. The fact that a resident can file a lawsuit does not outweigh the opportunity for abuse by those who want to discriminate. Now, of course, Brian Green said that you do have to be consistent, but I think Chris's point that, you know, one person may be able to file a lawsuit, another one may not. I mean, will this really result in more consistent policies?
Well, I think time will tell. And one of the things the industry would like would be, okay, if we take the individualized approach and maybe a subsequent bad act occurs, you know, is there some sort of safe harbor for limits of liability? You know, as an industry that wants to do these things, that wants to tailor, wants to individualize and not be accused of being inconsistent, that by doing those very tailoring and individualizing approaches that you could be held harmless in the event a bad act occurred after the fact.
And we also have a comment from Jane who says that she finds it absolutely amazing and wrong that anyone has to even admit to having a criminal record on any application. I know when it comes to employment, there have been conversations in Charlotte and in Mecklenburg County about so-called banning the box.
Correct.
Where you don't have to specify that when you're applying. Has there been any interest in doing something similar in housing?
Well, I know that that's been a conversation that several of us have had. And I think it's not, you know, once again, it goes back to, it's not that we don't want you to know. We don't want the application to be tossed in the trash before you have an opportunity to talk with the person and discover what the circumstances were and the context and give them a fair shot.
Yeah, but at the same time, from a landlord's perspective, I could see, you know, a very strong argument that this is an essential part of viewing an applicant because you have other tenants that you're trying to look after.
Yeah, if you read the guidelines, they talk about banning the box as an approach, and that should be the last thing you look at. You look at the totality of that applicant, and maybe you look at that last, and that still might kick it out. But to understand the context of all the favorable aspects of that applicant And, you know, society's been tough on felons. I mean, some states still prohibit you from voting for life if you've been a felon.
Well, and Ken, you've mentioned a couple of times how there will be a shift, essentially, in how landlords have to handle some of these things. How much is that happening now? I mean, how much time is it going to take to get to the point where you can carry out this guidance?
The guidelines came out on April 4th of 2016, so it's going to take a while. I suspect, you know, in the next, you know, 6, 12, 18 months, we'll have a sense of that. We're not going to have a sense of it in the next 30 days.
No, I don't think so either.
Well, and how much is there still a gray zone even with this guidance?
Well, there's got to be. There's going to be a leap of faith. If someone is a felon and you say, well, you know, this suggests that maybe I shouldn't exclude them, you know, different housing providers are going to take different views of the same applicants. It's not going to be an industry standard. As Brian suggests, it's private businesses. They make their own criteria, their own guidelines, their own approaches, their own screening criteria. So everyone look at it a little bit differently. They'll be advised by their lawyers and their experienced folks and their owners, and they'll go from there.
Okay, that is Ken Zemanski, who's Executive Director of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association. Myra Clark is Executive Director of the Center for Community Transitions. Thank you both so much for this hour.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Mine too.